AA. And since the most important aspect of AA recovery is one alcoholic relating to another, only alcoholics participate. If your primary problem is other than alcoholism, we think it would also be helpful for you to contact an anonymous organization which more specifically deals with your addiction. Our literature of persons have the list of such groups with their phone numbers. In any case, we hope that what you learn here may be helpful to your recovery and or understanding. And now Ariane will read the preamble.
Hi, my name is Ari and I'm an alcoholic. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problems and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. It does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and to help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety.
Please join in the serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. And now Wendy will read the steps.
Thanks. Hi, I'm Wendy. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Wendy.
Hi. 12 steps. 1, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. 2, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. 3, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. 4, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. 5, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. 6, were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. 7, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. 8, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. 9, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. 12, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs.
And now Dennis will read the traditions.
I'm Dennis Caron, I'm an alcoholic. The 12 traditions. 1, our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. 2, for our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God, as he may express himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. 3, the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. 4, each group should be autonomous except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. 5, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. 6, an AA group would never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. 7, each AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. 8, Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. 9, AA as such ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10, Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues, hence the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11, our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. 12, anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities.
The The format of this meeting is 2 10-minute speakers followed by our information break, and then our main speaker who will speak for 30 minutes. Our first 10-minute speaker is Alex N.
Hi, I'm Alex. I'm an alcoholic. Okay, so I got sober in 1991 on March 15th. My sponsor is Lisa Limbrinos. My grand sponsor is Marlena. I guess that makes my great grand sponsor Clancy. But I've only met him once, and he told me that my nose ring looked like a booger. It took me a long time to get over that one. I was born with, like most of you probably, just too many feelings. I just came out, I had way too many feelings, they were very painful, and I didn't know what to do with them. My mother was a psychoanalyst with an MD, Freudian. My father was a family doctor. And so they didn't know what to do with me either. So they did what they thought was right. So they sent me to analysis, Freudian, from first to sixth grade, 5 days a week, to talk about my feelings. And people would say to me, like, when I was a little girl, they'd say, "How are you?" And I'd say, "Not very good, but it's okay because I talk about it." So, moving ahead, I was very unhappy, tried a lot of different things, mostly a lot of fantasy. You know, I really just lived in my head. And when I was about 9 years old, I discovered my parents' liquor cabinet. And I had, you know, been watching Dynasty, and I had, you know, known what a mixed drink was. So I went and I made a mixed drink. I took some vermouth and some peppermint schnapps and some vodka and scotch, you know, and I put it all together and I drank it. And the most amazing thing happened. It was like the next thing I knew, I was okay. I just was okay. And it was that kind of relief that I was just like, that's it. That's what I need. I need a mixed drink. So I was maybe, you know, I was 9 years old, so halfway through my drink, I, you know, was reeling around the house, and my mom realized what was going on, and the next thing I know, I'm vomiting in the toilet, and she's holding my hair and saying, "Well, you know, it's good that you experimented," because, you know, I grew up in the 60s and 70s. So it's good that you experimented, but now you see what happens. You throw up, and, you know, I'm thinking, so what? You know? That's all I have to do? Whatever. So I basically just went on from there. I just, you know, learned how to drink. And my parents actually don't drink at all. And the funny thing was, you know, I did the water thing where you keep putting the water in the bottle. When I was about 21 or 22, I was home from college and I, you know, I could drink. It was legal. So I made myself like a vodka tonic. And it was all water. I was like, don't you guys buy any liquor? So I spent, you know, my high school years, I somehow struggled through high school. I got into college. I actually didn't get into college. I actually got into continuing education, where I stopped drinking for a year because everybody I knew left to go to school, and I was the only person in my parents' house with no friends. So I really didn't even drink. I drank very controlled, and I got straight A's, and I cleaned my apartment with, like, a Q-tip. I was, like, so tightly wrapped. And so I got good grades, and I got into a college where I could go away. And I went away to college, and I discovered nightclubs. I discovered the world of, I don't know if any of you know DC, but it was Trax. And, yeah. And I was just a screaming fag hag, and I was Edie Sedgwick. And, you know, I just had my little crew of friends, and we just had so much fun, and I barely remember any of it. I did become a nightclub promoter. I kind of like, you know, I just did this whole thing. This whole time my parents are paying for me to be in college, and so I'm Edie Sedgwick. So I don't know if any of you were Edie Sedgwick too, but she was a trust fund kid, and she was one of Andy Warhol's muses, so I, like, allotted one of my friends you know, to be Andy Warhol, and he just ran around yelling fabulous at everybody. And, you know, I just kept going on and on. And then the worst thing ever happened, I graduated. So that was a problem. So I kind of hung around and stuff, but my parents sort of wanted me to get a job, and I was just in like, oh my God, what am I going to do? I eventually ended up at a nightclub. I don't know. I was just 98 pounds. I drank. I lived above two liquor stores. I had running tabs. I drank like a bottle of gin before I went out. That was just to put the mascara on. And I went to a nightclub, and somebody, we were dancing, someone handed me a popper, and before you know it, I'm like on the floor. And I ended up in the manager's office with like some cocktail waitress who was like there to watch over me, and I couldn't breathe, and I wanted them to take me to the hospital, and they wouldn't do it because it was the opening of the club, and they didn't want, you know, bad press. So I sat there like, you know, holding on, and friends kept coming in and they kept going, oh my God, that was fabulous. And I was like, oh my God, these people, if I died, it would be so much better for them. They're not my friends. You know, like big revelation for me. So I went home that night and I woke up in the middle, like 8 o'clock in the morning, which to me was like really, really early. And, of course, I was surrounded by the miscellaneous people who just, whatever, fell asleep at my waterbed and stuff. And I found that I had been collecting AA literature. Now, this was unbeknownst to me, but it used to be at 4 o'clock in the morning, they used to do, like, do you have a drinking problem? And, you know, these PSA service announcements. And apparently I had been calling the number. And so I had this literature, and there was a meeting scheduled. So I went to the meeting, and they didn't understand how fabulous I was, and they didn't know, they didn't drink the same kinds of drinks that I did, and they didn't understand the pressure of fabulousness. And I just was like, I can't relate to this. And they suggested that perhaps I go to a meeting in another part of town. So I did. And, you know, basically what happened was I discovered I was an alcoholic, but I didn't stay. All I found out was it ruined my drinking. And so then I was stuck, and I had to figure out what I could do. I tried all these different dry goods. Nothing worked. Eventually, I ended up in Los Angeles because I figured by moving there, I would, through osmosis, be jogging on the beach eating granola. And they have nightclubs there, too. So I ended up there. I ended up in an AA meeting, and it was called Rodeo. And it was so fabulous. I mean, these people were beautiful, and they were celebrities, and everybody was talking to everybody, and I was so intimidated. I was like, this is it for me. So, you know, whatever keeps you coming, you know. And my first sponsor was in the Pacific Group. Yeah, she had just left the Pacific Group, but she was still, like, very Pacific Group. So she was like, okay, how many days a week did you drink? And I said, every day. She said, okay, so you have to go to a meeting every day that you drank. So you have to go to a meeting every day. You have to be there half an hour early. You have to save me a seat. You have to save my friend a seat. You have to raise your hand as a newcomer. You have to thank the birthday person. You have to thank the speaker. You have to, like, get a commitment. You have to call everybody who gives you their phone number. And you have to, like, get an egg timer. And you're only allowed to talk for 10 minutes on the phone. And then you have to hang up. That was the hardest part. I was like in the middle of my whole story and it was like, ding! I was like, oh, I gotta go, bye. So in short, a couple of things I want to mention before I get off. I wanted to mention a few things that I heard in Los Angeles that I don't hear out here, but it was really great. And one of them was uncover, discover, discard. And that was so important for me because so often when I was new, I found things horrible. And, you know, really, it's all about the process. It's uncovering it, discovering what it is, and then getting rid of it. And then there's this part where you're doing that, and you enter this dark room, and the door closes behind you, and they call it the hallway. And you're waiting for that next door to open, and it's not. I was told to decorate. So that's what I did. You know, I just learned how to be uncomfortable. I learned how to walk through things. And now, by the grace of God, I'm married. I have two beautiful children. I have this life that I never dreamed of, because honestly, I didn't think I was going to make it to 30. I mean, really, I was planning. Edie, I don't think, made it to 30, so, you know. So I wasn't planning to make it to 30. So now everything that happens to me is a gift. And the other thing that, the last thing I want to say is that they told me to wear my sobriety loosely. And I had no idea what they meant. And it took a long time for me to really get that. But now I realize that it's just about enjoying the ride. And I'm glad that you're here. Thank you for listening to me.
Our second 10-minute speaker is Matt L.
Hi, everybody. I'm Matt Littman, and I'm an alcoholic. And by the grace of God, the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, especially rooms like this, and strong sponsorship, I haven't found it necessary to take a drink since September 19th, 2004. And for that, I'm really grateful. And actually, you've heard that a couple of times traveling, especially just recently up in Pockets of Enthusiasm. All right. Which I've been to the last 3 years in a row, and I will keep going back because it's just an amazing gift. It's an amazing gift to be away with people from this room, to be enjoying sobriety. And that's what we do. And talk about, you know, wearing sobriety loosely. I mean, to get away and to do that is such a gift. I'm going to share my experience, strength, and hope with you. What it was like the book says, I'm going to disclose in a general way what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. God, I'm so nervous. I've done this a couple of times here. I used to have a great commitment up here where I got a 30-minute. Never gets comfortable. And thank God, because then my ego would just be like, it's bad enough, but it would be worse if that's possible. Okay, so I was born to... we'll take it all the way back. All right. I was born to two alcoholic parents, hippies. And yeah, all right. And they moved from their little one-bedroom apartment out to... my mom's dad loaned them some money, and they moved out to a house out in Comac, Long Island. And my mom, they totally did not fit in. They decided they had a glass screen door. They painted, "Peace to all who enter here." And this was like a Catholic Jewish neighborhood where everyone was like very prim and proper. And here's my mom with the braids and the... and my dad with the curls. He looked like Roger Daltrey and like the Tommy the movie. And... So I was like totally, you know, growing up, all of a sudden I'm like totally this stranger and that weird kid and that kid of those weird parents. And to be an alcoholic and to have that gene, because I believe we are born with this thing, you know, it is a disease that we're born with. It didn't make anything very easy for me. I was also the smallest kid. I wasn't a very good athlete, and I just did not fit in. So when liquor presented itself to me at an early age, I think around, I was 13 or 14 years old, not the first drink I ever had, but the first drunk I ever had, the time to really get it going. It was a block party in my neighborhood. I got invited by some of the older kids, and I got really drunk. And it was like the early 80s, and it was heavy metal music, and it was like Black Sabbath, Iron Man, and I'm like drinking my beer and just getting going. And sure enough, I drank way too much, and I puked, and I got really sick, and I had to get carried home, and it was a mess, and I was a mess. And you know, I was really like not feeling very well the next day, and by all means I should not have ever drank again after that. But you know what, I was cool. I was hanging out with cool people, and it did for me what I was not being able to do for myself at that time. And I chased that feeling for many years, and I started getting into a lot of trouble. And my parents ended up making some money, and they went from like hippies to like preppies, you know. Then it became like the late 80s, and it was like yuppies. And they moved to a nicer house, so we moved to a different neighborhood. And I started getting in trouble. My parents didn't know what to do with me. They sent me to boarding school, And sure enough, they didn't know what to do with me, so they sent me overseas. The boarding school was like, oh, we have a great program for you. It's in London. Your son Matthew would be perfect for this. So they shipped me off to London, and I got there, and I found that you could drink. They had lager in soda cans that came from a dispensing machine. So I started drinking in between classes there, and I got in trouble. And before they decided to throw me out, though, I was getting into fights pretty much every day. I was like the Yank, and I didn't fit in, and all these other things. And I said, you know what, if... I'm gonna attempt to suicide because that'll get them to throw me out of here. Like, they wouldn't listen to me. My parents wouldn't listen to me. They wouldn't take me home. And sure enough, I did that, and they sent me to the hospital. And then the school was just like, you know what? We've had enough of them. And the school back in Long Island that did the transfer thing said we had enough with them. And I went back to public school. And then my parents get this great idea. They made some more money. They decided to move to a nicer house, like further into Nassau County. And this is senior year, and I was like the new kid in a new school in senior year, and it was just like, at that point, I was just off to the races. I didn't fit in, and I just drank, and I picked up drugs at that time, too, and it's a big part of my story, and I won't talk about it, but the bottom line is I chased that feeling from through my 20s into my 30s until I got into this very destructive relationship where... I was told, you know, you really need to look into drinking. This is the first time in all my life that anyone really cared about me to tell me that I should do that. And I went to see a therapist. I went to see a psychiatrist because I thought I didn't have a drinking problem, but I had a psychological problem. And then he would fix me, give me a pill or something like that. And sure enough, he did give me some pills. But he said to me, you know what, you have another problem. You're an addict. And you are an alcoholic probably, and I want you to at least, I want to check you into a hospital. And I was like way too vain to go into a hospital, you know, for a program. So I was like, well, why don't you go see at least my drug and alcohol therapist? And I did that. And I went to see him, and he told me that, you know, after I shared with him a couple of times, a couple of weeks, he said, I can't help you with what you have. The only way that you're going to get help is by going to AA. And that is like, there's a story in the big book that talks about that. And this doctor, therapist, had enough lacking of ego to tell me to do that. And he saved my life. And sure enough, you know, I didn't listen to him right away, of course. And then I went to see him a couple more times. And he told me, look, you're just wasting your time here. And you need to go to AA. And I said to him, you know, but I'm giving you money. And he's like, you know, it doesn't matter. You know, you're wasting my time. Forget about your money. So I did listen to him. I went to a meeting. And then I kind of liked it a little bit, you know. I audited the rooms of AA for about a few months, but I didn't do anything that they told me to do. I didn't get, you know, I got a sponsor who gave me a business card. I thought I could get business from him. So guy gave me a business card. I'm like, well, he could be a good candidate. So I asked him to be my sponsor. But I didn't get get active in a home group. I didn't get a commitment. I didn't do anything that they told me. And sure enough, I thought it was after 5 months of sobriety to reward myself with a trip to Bahamas for the weekend by myself. And I got there and I got off the elevator. I got changed and I was going to the beach. You know, it was the first day there. And I got into the elevator and there were these two girls and they're like, hey, how you doing? I'm like, where are you going? They're like, we're going to buy alcohol. Where are you going? I'm like, I'm going with you guys. So there went my five, you know, non-strong months in AA. And it was back to off the races. You know, the book talks about how we never get better, we get worse, and I got worse. And I came to a point where I had like a really bad night, and I blacked out, and I woke up, I didn't know where I was and what was going on, and I called a friend of mine, and he told me, you know, why don't you try to go back to AA? And he also recommended that I call his sponsor at the time, who was a member of this group, who told me to meet him outside his apartment. I'll never forget, I drove back into the city. I was working in Long Island that day, and he came out of my car. It was pouring rain. It was like thundering out, and it was like ominous. And he's like, you know, if you want to get sober, you're going to do this. And for some reason, I listened to him. And sure enough, I came here, and it was a big room. And if you're new, it's like, you know, I got here, and it was like scary and everything like that. But you know what? I finally found what I needed. And I started to slowly get better. And that was because he took me through the steps. We did the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous as they're laid out in the big book. And my life started to change. My best step experience was in doing the ninth step with my father before he died. And he told me, you know, my sponsor told me that when you're doing an amends, ask, is there anything I left out, and is there anything I could do to make this up to you? And my father said, just stop, you know, stop messing with your mom. Be a man already. And, you know, he died slowly after that, and I got an opportunity to do that, and I would have never have happened. This was a woman who she used to call. I'd look at my cell phone, I'd be like, click, ignore. You know, I would never been able to deal with that. And because of AA and because of the steps, I'm able to deal with that now and be the man that she needs me to be. And, you know, I'm really grateful. I've gotten some crazy news just recently that I'm not quite sure what I'm going to do or how I'm going to get through it. But just like with my dad's death and everything else because of sobriety, I know that God's going to take care of me and everything's going to be okay. So thank you all. Good night.